Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, we're pleased to have with us, once again, Anthony Mara, who we last spoke with about his prize-winning novel and one of our favorites at the bookshop, A Constellation of Vital Phenomena. Wow, back in 2013. Can't believe it's 2 years. Anthony also wrote The Wolves of Balaya Forest and his new collection of short stories, perhaps sneakily almost a novel, is The Tsar of Love and Techno, which was released on October 6th by Hogarth. Anthony's won a Pushcart Prize, Narrative Prize, the Whiting Award, and others. The Tsar of Love and Techno, which Anthony has likened to a literary mixtape, could be said, simply, to be a novel about Russia, absurd dictatorships, censorship, and sometimes depressing characters who strive for things they cannot achieve. But I would rather call it a skein of time and space, love, despair, longing, and, yes, magic. The characters are woven in and out of the stories. Each stand alone, but when read as a whole, do, in fact, weave metaphorically into a tapestry of a specific universe, which is populated by lovers, brothers, fathers, uncles, pollution in both the literal and figurative sense, and above all, a certain kind of magic, perhaps tinged with mercury, nickel, and betrayal, but magic nonetheless. And in some, much as in Anthony Doerr's All the Light We Cannot See, we find ourselves entranced and amazed at who has done what and the repercussions of the actions they omitted or committed in their lifetime. Hi, Anthony. Welcome back to The Avid Reader. I've missed you, as I said.
Thank you so much for having me on and for that beautiful introduction. I can't believe it's been 2 years as well. We've gotten so old.
I started out way older, so, you know, we go by percentages of lifetimes. And all, well, here I go. Before I go off on my tangents, which you know well, why don't you just tell us a little bit about the book, the novel versus short stories thing, and even the mixtape on Spotify that you created, and then we'll go from there.
All right, yeah. It's the Tsar of Love and Techno is somewhere between a novel and a short story collection. You know, I'm sure that in some other language there's the perfect word to describe it, but I feel like in English we don't really have a great term for those books that occupy the in-between space. Sometimes we call them linked stories, but that always sounds to me like a dating website or something like that. But books like, you know, Let the Great World Spin or Visit from the Goon Squad and so on, like that are able to harness, you know, the sort of intense, concentrated power of a short story, yet use that to string together a much larger narrative. And so The Tsar of Love and Techno sort of spans about 80 years of Russian history, three generations, and it follows several families and several objects, several works of art that sort of tie their various stories together as it sort of traces this legacy, as you mentioned, of betrayal and forgiveness and so on.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, owning an independent bookshop, you've made me betray my loyalties because I read this on my iPad Mini because you can hit that little magnifying glass, because when I read the word Lydia, I'm thinking to myself, I'm, you know, a third of the way through the book, and I'm going, Lydia, I know I've heard that name somewhere. And so then I would press the magnifying glass and go back, and then I would say, oh, Lydia. And now I remember what happened. And, you know, I think I read closely, but you really made me work hard, which is what I'm looking for. But if I see Vladimir's name and then I think, wait a minute, I'll go back. But then he's not named until a certain point. So then so what happened was I got pissed off at you because then I had to stay up really late. Then I had to take the kids to school the next day. So I'm exhausted all day. I had four espressos. Luckily, we have a coffee bar. and it's all because of you. So,
well, I apologize for the lack of sleep, and I promise, you know, that nobody, that none of your colleagues at in the independent bookstore world will know, so long as this isn't recorded. but thank you. I really, that was sort of one of, I feel like my favorite novels tend to be those where you read them once and you immediately want to read them again. Not that you necessarily have to. You know, I feel like a book needs to work its first time through. But that you feel that there's this sort of undercurrent of complexity that would reward multiple readings. And you know, the echo chamber has become sort of maybe one of my defining metaphors for what I want to my books to be. And in that, I hope that as you progress through one of my books, you get the sense that there are all of these echoes from things you've read previously. I don't want, you know, a wasted word, a wasted paragraph or scene. I want everything to sort of resound throughout the entire book. And so one of the ways with the Tsar of Love and Techno that I tried to accomplish that was by sort of introducing a number of characters as very peripheral minor characters in the first several stories, and then in the later stories they end up sort of coming on stage as in a starring role. And in those stories, you know, the previous sort of central protagonists end up becoming more minor figures. And this idea that, you know, we're each sort of you know, we're each starring in our own story, and yet there are all of these other people who are starring in their own stories and who have these extraordinary impacts on our lives and the choices we make, and, you know, how difficult it is sometimes to see that same story from their perspective. And that was sort of my my attempt maybe to reconcile some of that.
And I was kidding. I mean, when our readers, who are close readers, read this book, it's fun to go back. It's fun to flip back and do exactly that. And it's like, it's kind of like a paradox, because the harder the reader has to work, the more, well, maybe it's not a paradox, the more the reader gets out of the book. And you send this out to us and you say, okay, you know, you go ahead and read this, but, you know, you're going to have to work to understand exactly what's coming together and how it's coming together. I think readers, good readers, appreciate that, and I think they will in this book.
And yeah, I mean, David Mitchell has long been, you know, maybe my favorite.
Me too.
My favorite writer, and I feel like that's really the case with a lot of his books, that he asks a lot of his readers, but he really, you know, he rewards it. I've never finished one of his books feeling that that it wasn't worth, you know, every single moment. And you know, I certainly hope that maybe readers of Tsar will finish it
yeah.
with a similar feeling.
Yeah, I've interviewed David for both the Bone Clocks and now the new one, Slate House, and, you know, it's just like, it's the same as you. It's just like, and I can say this, you can't, but I could read Gone Girl, or I could read David Mitchell or you. To me, there's really not much of a choice, not much of a question. It's not that I'm saying, okay, here's fiction, beach read stuff, and here's literature, although I do consider your book literature. It's just that if you read Cloud Atlas, or All the Light We Cannot See, or one of your books, it's just so much more, well, like I said, it's more work for the reader, but there's much more reward at the end. And what you were saying, too, is that, and I even wrote it down, I wrote the characters are at time wisps and at other times full-blown. And what you're saying is correct. Their interconnectivity is almost like a sine wave. You don't know which ones are going to be, well, for example, your epigraph, which is, it's a minor work. Explain the epigraph, and I can't pronounce the name of the guy who wrote it.
Yeah, so that was, it's a minor work, it's a fictitious epigraph by a real painter, referring to a fictitious painting that sort of is woven throughout the book. I needed to figure out a way of introducing this painting on the very first page, because it ends up becoming this hugely important It becomes sort of the needle on which the thread of these various storylines are sort of woven throughout the book. So I needed to introduce it on the very first page, and so I decided I would sort of create this little supposed quote that Pyotr Zakharov, this 19th century Chechen painter, said, and it's the quote is, as you said, it's a minor work, and part of it is a bit of a bit of a self-deprecating joke, I suppose. You know, most people don't really open. I shouldn't say that. I should say that the most common reaction I got from readers of Constellation who asked me, "What are you doing next?" You know, they'd say, "What are you doing next?" And I'd say, I'm working on a short story collection, and usually there'd be immediate disappointment.
Of course.
and so sort of calling it, you know, saying it's a minor work at the beginning was a bit of a joke, I suppose. But the painting in question is this fictitious painting by this real 19th century painter who Pyotr Zakharov, who was born in Chechnya and later was brought to St. Petersburg and was raised there in the Russian court and became this one of the very few Chechens to sort of ascend to this position of prominence. And this painting called Empty Pasture and Afternoon is referred to as the sort of the most mundane, the least artistically, the least of his artistic achievements, and yet it holds this immense power and emotional sort of importance to a vast number of characters. And I kind of love the idea of one of these paintings hanging sort of in the corner of the museum that 99 out of 100 people would walk by without looking twice. Everybody in the museum, they're going to see the Picasso or the Michelangelo or whatever. Nobody's looking at this tiny little painting, and yet it contains, within it a story that is so much more dramatic and just so much richer than what it first appears. And hopefully, this short story collection is doing something similar, that it may at first appear to be modest, but hopefully it is, in fact, quite ambitious.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's cool about the epigraph is we really all are minor works, but it's when you examine those minor works very closely, you see that there's all kinds of things going on that, as in a Greek tragedy, for example, there's all kinds of things going on that elevate these little human beings into something far more heroic and tragic. And
yeah.
And that's what this shows. But then, it's funny, in all your interviews, some of your interviews, you talk about the short time you spent in Russia. But here in this book alone, we're talking about Leningrad, Kirovsk, Grozny, Chechnya, the Highlands, St. Petersburg. And I won't say the last place because that would be a spoiler.
I have not spent any time in the last place.
Okay, well, that was good. I like that. But so what is it that draws you back, because it's drawing you back all the time?
Well, this, this is my second book, and it's the last one that I'm writing about the Russian world. I was working on Constellation, and I would retype every draft from the beginning, and each time that I finished a draft of Constellation, I'd take 1 or 2 months off and I'd write some short stories. And since Constellation was so focused on the Chechen conflict, pretty much exclusively from the Chechen perspective, I kind of wanted to write some stories about Russia, sort of to create a little internal ballast, maybe in my own imagination. And so, by the time I finished Constellation, I more or less had this other second book, collection of short stories, sort of waiting in the wings. And I spent a couple years sort of weaving the stories together to make it more novelistic. But really, I wanted it to be a companion piece to Constellation. I sort of see Constellation being almost being a figure in a much larger diorama And that larger diorama maybe is Tsar, which sort of shows this much larger geographical and historical and cultural and political context, this sort of whole confluence of events that results in the collapse of the Soviet Union and this conflict emerging in Chechnya and sort of trying to see that background against which Constellation sort of stands.
Yeah, and kind of like going back to David Mitchell, if you look at Bone Clocks and then Slade House, you know, you have these characters coming back in, and just like I did with your book, I'm going, oh yeah, I remember them. And then I'd go back to Bone Clocks and look at that, and he did the same thing. So it's almost, it is kind of, I think he even said it to me, it's kind of a companion piece. But, hey, you want to hear something really weird?
Hit me with it.
Okay. 3 months before I knew anything about your book, I wrote this story about two guys that are thrown into this cylindrical pit, and they're soldiers. And it's 20 feet deep, and the sides are smooth earthen work, as if a drill bit connected to a drill has just drilled the hole in the ground. And they're not given any food, but every day someone lowers a rope with a bucket that has food and water, although since I'm not a writer, I don't know how you can mix food and water together in a bucket. But in any event, they stay there until a father and son come along, and the son, not the father, is in charge. And the son drops a ladder down, and he says, all right, get out of there. And as soon as they climb up, the son and the father run away, and the son turns back over his shoulder and says, just get out of here, okay? Isn't that weird?
That is weird. It's funny, though, because this is the story you're referring to in Tsar, A Prisoner of the Caucasus, is sort of my riff on this very old story cycle called The Prisoner of the Caucasus. Tolstoy, Pushkin, Lermontov, to a somewhat lesser extent, wrote either poems or short stories with that title, and each one had followed a fairly similar plot, which involved, you know, these two soldiers in Chechnya being tossed into one of these pits and being held as prisoner. And in each version, you sort of see how the particular aesthetics of each writer's era comes through and changes this essential this similar captivity narrative. So in Pushkin's version, it's this, you know, highly romanticized and exoticized captivity narrative, whereas in Tolstoy's, it becomes this this sort of starkly the stark realism. And so I tried to do, you know, something similar and sort of saw this very grim humor, this sort of,
yes,
the voice of a world bereft of reason, as being the sort of maybe the kind of aesthetics that best describe the conflict at that sort of moment nearer to the present day.
Yeah, the humor derives in great part from the fact that once you reduce the value of human life, and you're not so concerned with the possibility of death, or perhaps it beats the alternatives, you can really have a good time. And Kolya and Danilo, who I wrote down, is built like a flour sack with a brain wired like a bargain firecracker, because I know someone exactly like that.
I think we all do.
But you also made my...
Do you know Ted, too?
But, well, it's like, you know, do I know Ted, too? It's like when he's trying to figure out, how can I make this city sound like it's, you know, when these feral dogs are chasing this guy, and he writes down, you know, wonderful wildlife experiences. But then he looks up brochures about Houston, because it's just as bad a place. But I was just wondering, have you been to Houston to sign this book yet? And are you going to go?
I haven't, but I was doing a reading. where was I? I was in at Odyssey Books in North South Hadley, and this very kind and just absolutely wonderful bookseller said she was from Houston, and so I sort of had to apologize because I read from that section, but yeah,
it's really funny, and Kolya and Danilo together, it was starting to sound like Waiting for Godot a little bit to me, And it was so much of it was so hilarious because they were so sarcastic with each other, but there was true affection between them. And then, you know, the photograph and all that. But and then at the end, it's so poignant and leads back to the very beginning in the epigraph and the painting that goes throughout the book and how much it means to each other, to everybody. And Danilo knows what's happening and why it's happening, even though it's happening from afar. And so you keep drawing the reader back almost like with rubber bands or bungee cords to that same hill and what happens on that hill.
Yeah. I think that's a lovely way to put it, I think. That it's sort of like that it almost becomes, it's sort of a book that is, among other things, fascinated with space, outer space. And that hill, in its own way, sort of becomes the center of gravity around which these sort of the broken, the fragmented dust rings of narrative to be sort of obscenely poetic are gradually sort of revolving around, and it does all come back to that hill to some extent, and I absolutely think that that in those situations where the sort of the physics the moral physics of of a character's reality begin to bend a little bit, it's absolutely essential that humor creeps in, just because none of these characters are are unaware of just how far their lives have veered from normalcy.
Well,
and I think that space is occupied by this sense of sort of dark humor.
Yeah, and a perfect example is Galina, who shouldn't be where she goes to with the 14th richest oligarch. Like someone said, maybe you, I don't know, 14th is a good number where you're not going to end up in jail in Russia. If you're the third most richest, you might. But in any event, so you have Galina, and you have Sergei coming to see her, and you have the painting being bought from the guy. Anyway, so you everything keeps coming together. But what I wanted to ask about was because I fell in love. Am I pronouncing it right? Is it Galina or Galina?
Yeah.
So it's Galina. So I fell in love with her, as I think you're supposed to. But then when she takes pictures of herself, she realizes that the only parts of her that are perfect are between her neck and her ankles. But I have this babe in mind but she's not a babe. She's kind of wholesome. She kind of looks like Glinda in The Wizard of Oz.
Well, I think it's also that we each see what we want to see about ourselves. That, I think that that very, very successful people are insecure about their success. Very beautiful people are insecure about beauty. I think that that sort of comes with the territory and hopefully some of those scenes from her perspective, since we first meet her, she's being entirely described by this group of
the grandmothers,
who aren't who are as enamored by her as they are sort of piteous of her as they are maybe jealous of her, and so they have their own very very stark biases and resentments when describing her life. So when we later sort of see a bit more of her story from a less slanted angle, you begin to see that she's a bit more complex than we might originally have been led to believe.
Do you think she's beautiful?
I have no idea. I don't actually. When I write, I don't really imagine faces.
Really?
I would have no idea who would play anybody in a movie. I think Galina's face is described, but if you look through most of my work, faces are almost never described.
Except for Ryan Gosling.
That's true. That is true. He does look a lot like Ryan Gosling.
Which is really good. And the funny thing is, you bring in Scarface, Goodfellas, you bring in Lindsay Lohan, for God's sake. It's really funny when you do, because it stops you. You know what I mean? You're right inside of this, and
it's not a place where you would think Ryan Gosling and Lindsay Lohan would crop up. But one of the things that I was sort of amazed when I spent a couple of weeks in Chechnya was that was just the American references sort of everywhere. There's this joke in the Grozny Tourist Bureau about don't worry, I'm a limo driver. That phrase becoming sort of a catchphrase. And it's something that Jim Carrey says in Dumb and Dumber. And it actually, I ran into that a couple times. People saying, don't worry, I'm a limo driver.
And the poor Japanese guys, they don't, and he goes, get it? Don't you get it? From
right.
Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah.
But it's like the way, you can talk about, let's segue into this, is when, you know, you talk about Tupac and Biggie, but it's with these group of boys, and tell us what the group of boys are trying to do so they don't have to get conscripted.
Well, yeah, they're 18 years old, and there's in Russia you it's compulsory that you serve in the military unless you can go to university, and so or get a doctor's exemption, both of which unless you're quite bright or legitimately sickly require bribes, and their parents are not not well off enough to supply any bribes. And so because there's this conflict in Chechnya and because people are, you know, coming back quite banged up, they decide that it's safer to try to go to prison for the length of the war, so that when they come out, they won't have to go to Chechnya.
And it's like really it's like a futures market. It's almost like pork
exactly.
belly futures.
Yeah, they're sort of trying to guess how many years it would take, and there's this irony in that if they'd spent this much time sort of, you know, they're studying the various sentencing for various crimes, and you know, the irony is that if they had spent, you know, half of this much time in school, they might have actually gotten into college and legitimately been exempted, but they sort of dream of being these sort of American kingpins, and they go around calling each other by not by their real names, not by their patronymics or their diminutives, but by the names of of Michael Corleone and what's his name? The Al Pacino character from Scarface, and these sort of Hollywoodized American figures of kingpin slain in prime.
Yeah, it's funny. Like when you read those words, as I say, you don't recognize that it is their reality, and then you because it's. See, how can I explain this without spoiling your spoilers? So Sergei does something. Sergei's a very complicated character because he does some things that, wow, I can't believe he just did that. And then he turns out to be, in a sense, almost like an angel to a certain degree, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's hard for the reader to accept it, not to understand it, but it's a little hard to accept it. And I don't mean it's done in any awkward fashion. It's done in a beautiful fashion. But it's hard to accept that he's got all this stuff going on in his head. He's got a lot of stuff going on in his head.
Yeah. I think he certainly does. I feel like one of the important things to for me to try to do as a writer is to always maybe upend a reader's expectations regarding who can do what, who can think what, how certain people are. And I would think that if you were to pass a kid like him, with this, he wears, you know, these ridiculous XXXXXL, sweatshirts, and yet sort of everything we might have been told by culture at large about, you know, what his dreams are, what his fears are, the square footage of his soul, sort of would only diminish who he actually is, that he is instead this you know, much more complex person who is capable of feeling and thinking and embodying, you know, these great contradictions.
Well, you have him, you know, the scene in the subway is the one I'm talking about, but also I like when Vladimir, who's, I'm not sure if we know he's Vladimir yet, but when Vladimir takes him to Kirill, is it Kirill or Kirill?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kirill. When he takes him to Kirill and he says, "This is my son, but you may call him." That was one, I don't know why that's one of my favorite lines, but it is. And I guess it reminds me of my father. Except it was Jackass. But what it was, it took me years of therapy to realize he was telling me he loved me, which is essentially what Vladimir is doing too, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That you know, one. it takes Sergei a while to hear as actually being "I love you, son."
Yeah, I know, but the reader can tell, and the reader can tell without you actually saying specific words, and that's what's kind of magical too. And if you talk about magical, which I've said several times now, it's not like I'm getting into the idea, whether you like it or don't like it, of magical realism. But and again, without spoiling it, there's a certain part of the book that resonates throughout the book in a certain way they put together objects, expecting them to work in a way. I did the same thing. I built one of those things with my brother, and we really expected that we were going to get in it, and it was going to do what it was supposed to do. We really did. But unfortunately, we used my father's mahogany wood to do it with, so he was very, very upset. And then in the book, when it actually works the way it's supposed to work, there was no suspension of disbelief on my part. I just said, yeah, of course, obviously. But
yeah, well, part of this was also because I sort of had these various stories that were not connected at all when I began. And this final story, which is, probably won't be spoiling too much to say that it's set in outer space, was one of those stories, and I really wanted to end the book with that story, and so I sort of had to find a way to make it work, since I had every other story let's just say is set on Earth. So it was sort of this cobbling together of various pieces. I sort of felt like a bit like a puzzle maker trying to chip away and sand and smooth the edges so that the various pieces would just slide one by one into place. And I do think that maybe the overall effect is one. It's interesting that you've used the word magic a couple times. Since it's not as you said magical realism, but there is something about all my work, I think, that is maybe just skewed a couple degrees off of reality or off of realism. Like I don't really consider myself a realist writer, but I'm not sure what else I am either. I feel like I'm closest to that, but just off by a couple of centimeters maybe.
I think that's what gives readers and your work and others hope, because everyone hopes that they see a sign, you know, just give me a sign. And you do. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in that last story, you do. You give us a sign. Plus, it's literally and figuratively cosmic, because what happens is that, well, in the book, there's this tape that Kolya gets that's to be used only in an emergency. And then when it's finally played, you recognize, I kept thinking, it's not going to be anything. And it really wasn't anything, but it was everything at the same time. And so you leave us floating there with everything kind of being like, okay, you've been through all of this, and yet it's all okay.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way of putting it. I think, I tried to do something similar with Constellation in that, Constellation sort of ends, you know, the last page. It's you know, basically within a circle of hell, and yet I think it's the last page of that book has been the thing by far and away that most people that the most people who have read anything that I've ever written have told me about, or who have you know, written me you know, nice emails, or that sort of thing. It's 9 times out of 10, it'll be about that last page of Constellation, and I think it's because it is, you know, it's a place that should, by all accounts, be devoid of any light, of any warmth, of any hope, of any love, of any redemption, of any, you know, of anything good, and yet I think that it is a deeply hopeful and joyous ending, and I think with the ending of Zara, I sort of I wanted to reach a similar place, you know, not obviously it's very far away, but emotionally, I think there's something incredibly powerful about the idea that that in this desolate, this poor guy is in a space capsule about to exit the universe, about to exit the solar system. He's the last living human being. You know, there is, by definition of his circumstances, no hope whatsoever, and yet he listens to this tape and he hears something that for him in that moment does mean everything.
It
is hope.
What is so cool about that is you couldn't have known it, but you have him going past Pluto and Charon, and it's exactly the time that our spacecraft is doing exactly the same thing, taking a picture that's very like the picture that he paints, unless you already knew that was happening.
No, I didn't.
But the picture he paints of Pluto is pretty much, if you've looked at NASA's page, it's pretty much the image that the spacecraft got as it was passing by Pluto.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is really odd. But when I was like 16 or 17 and I was not in this state of consciousness one night, I was in a similar situation where I was doomed to be in this circle of hell. There was no way I could escape. I would be there for all of eternity. And things kept getting smaller and smaller until I was backed into this acute corner where there was never the possibility of being with anyone, seeing anyone, being loved and all that. And then all of a sudden, out of the corner, this white lotus flower bloomed. And it was like, okay, well, yeah, I have that now. And
wow,
that reminded me a little bit of it.
Yeah, that's incredible.
But if you, you know, the thing is, there's so many little spots like that scared me, but also were so true that it didn't bother me being scared. Like when you said, turning "I would" into "I did" is the grammar of growing up. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's scary. Because it hits home immediately, and I think, oh wait, I didn't do that stuff. I didn't do that I was going to do. You know,
yeah.
I think I'm going to write a book. Well, you're not going to write a book if you say I think I'm going to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, and there's a lot of lines like that. I don't know where do they come from, for God's sakes. Are you stealing them from somewhere?
Well, so I am constantly trying to make my girlfriend laugh, and so sometimes I'll like try out new material on her a little bit, like I'll slide in, you know, if I've written like what I think is, you know, pretty funny or pretty good line, I'll sort of slide it in conversation, you know, very subtly. Suddenly we'll be talking about outer space, for example. Or just, you know, in joking around when we're hanging out, when we're, you know, walking around town or something, if I can really crack her up, I'll immediately, you know, say, hold on a second, let me write that down. Which I'm sure makes me, absolutely insufferable.
It's kind of nerdy.
But she is, you know.
Well, I bet you I can tell you one of the
my
ones.
My light and my muse.
I bet you I can tell you one that you did that for her. It would be where Akeem is driving Sergey around, and he goes, "This is Chechnya. You don't need seat belts."
No, but okay, I did not try that one out. No, but I did. That line is taken directly from a conversation that I had when I arrived to the Grozny airport. I went to in this beat up old Lada. I was picked up, and I went to put on my seat belt, and the guy who was driving me, he turned to me with this sort of this look of bafflement and pity, and said, "This is Chechnya. You don't need seatbelts," which sort of, in so many ways, just sort of seemed to sum up, everything about the place.
Yeah, it's like a hall pass. It's like so many people in New York, myself included. I don't put my seatbelt on in cabs, but I don't know why I don't. And my kids are always yelling at me, "Dad, put your seatbelt on! Put your seatbelt on!" And I think, no, it's free. It's a free ride. You don't need to put it on.
Yeah.
And I was going to say? Oh yeah, when Danilo's wife, that was hilarious, but also really sad. But then I like when he says, tell Captain Theophon. How do you pronounce that, Theophon? His first name?
Yeah.
Yeah. When tell him, come on, please give me help. And he writes back, "May the devil take you both. Respectfully yours."
Yeah. I mean, I think the darker the material, the more playful you need to be with it. The more light that you need to let come through the ceiling, I think.
Well, what about stuff that makes no sense at all, but it does? Like, the day everybody, you can talk about this because it's not spoiling anything. You talk about a town where you have the 12 apostles and it's a nickel smelting plant. And what about the day they go and swim in this lake that's toxic and they're having a great time, but they know what it's doing to them, but they don't care anymore, right? I mean, tell me, just talk about that a little bit instead of me talking.
Yeah, I suppose it may have just been an image, that I've been turning around for a while. I wanted to sort of maybe to lesser extent, but maybe the same impulse as sort of when I was describing the very end of the book and the end of Constellation. I wanted to show this incredibly exuberant and lovely and magical even day in the midst of a decidedly unexuberant and unmagical and very grim landscape. And following, following the fall of the USSR, these former prison laborers decide to go swimming, and it's sort of almost like they're unshackling themselves not only from this historical legacy that they've been trapped under, but are also striking off every vestige of authority, every edict and prescription, including the sign in front of the lake that says, the chemicals in the water cause cancer. And so they end up swimming, and gradually this turns into this polluted lake that because of its chemicals stays, warm, even in the midst of a Siberian winter. It becomes this place where families go, and they go for a swim in this one family, Alexei and his brother Kolya, who are two of the probably the two central characters in the whole book, go there, and their father gives them leopard print bikinis before they go, and of course they're boys, they don't want to wear bikinis, so he throws out the tops and says that now they're leopard print speedos, and they have this kind of this really joyful day, something that they both remember for the rest of their lives, and yet it is in a sort of the circumstances is such that for anybody else it would be it would be awful. You'd go to the hospital afterwards.
You're right.
It would be this horror story you'd tell people about the time you accidentally swam in a polluted lake. And I think that there's something in my work that comes up again and again, and it's trying to jar the reader, I guess, by smushing together emotions and context that we normally don't associate with each other. We never associate polluted landscape with kind of exuberant adolescent experiences. We don't really associate torture prisons with with the possibility of experiencing this transcendent joy as happens at the end of consolation. We don't associate all of these things necessarily with one another. And I think because we don't, when we see that there is the possibility of those kinds of transcendences in these places, it maybe rewires the way we experience that narrative, you know, in our neural circuitry to some extent.
Yeah, it's like you do that in the prison here too, where the man's confession, which he doesn't give but is beautifully molded, but he doesn't give it, and the transcendent moment in that scene is when his Polish teacher finally, even though she's not supposed to do it, gives him the name of, you know, how you say a leopard in the zoo in Polish. Mm-hmm. And there's this moment of transcendence there that, you know, this transfer of love or whatever you want to call it. Why have you been letting me call Alexei Sergei this entire interview?
Oh, I figured we'd just go with it. I thought at first you were talking about the real, because there is a character named Sergei, so I thought you were talking about him.
Now I got confused. Sorry.
No.
And then the other thing is, in, you know, obviously in America, when there's a cell phone tower, we pretend it's a tree by putting these little sticks on it, or like if you put up a stone screening wall in the turnpike, so the houses of the rich people don't hear the turnpike, they stamp these etchings of trees in the side of them. And
yeah.
Talk a little bit about the forest and why it was created and what it's made of.
It's sort of it's this. So it's set in this town called Kirov, which is where maybe a third of the stories are set, which is loosely sort of inspired by this real town in the Arctic, in Siberia, called Norilsk, and both of these towns are were started as gulag camps in the 30s, and following the decommissioning of the gulag system in the 50s, most of the former prisoners just decided to stay on and to live there, and in my version of this town, Kirovsk, it becomes this incredibly prosperous mining town, and in order to try to trick engineers from Petersburg and Moscow to come out, or Leningrad, I should say, to come out to take up mining. Mining jobs, and because the party boss's wife misses, you know, the birch trees of her youth, the party boss decides to commission this like sort of massive forest of fake trees to sort of spruce up this Arctic wasteland to make it look more like, you know, a nice forest. And of course, by the time our heroes are growing up, Alexei and Kolya, the forest, this fake forest, has more or less disintegrated, and you have these sort of rusted trunks sticking out of the ground and these drooping, yellowed, saggy leaves everywhere, and it's sort of like something from a Tim Burton nightmare. And yet again, it becomes this place where their imaginations are sort of without limits, and it becomes a place of both wonder and horror for them as they grow up.
Hey, so did you tell your girlfriend about starting an autoerotic asphyxiation service?
Yeah, I did.
Damn, I knew I'd get one.
I think you know, I had to say immediately that it's from a book. I'm not really into autoerotic asphyxiation. Don't worry. yeah, but no, I did.
That was pretty good of me, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, with that, okay.
Yeah, I'm glad you're ending it. You're ending it on a high note.
So, Anthony, thanks again for putting up with me for a second time. It was great having you here, and I look forward to the next time.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a lot of fun.
So that was Anthony Mara, the second time we've interviewed him. First one was Constellation, and this one is The Tsar of Love and Techno. And it's a wonderful, wonderful book, as was Constellation of Vital Phenomena. And, you know, we're talking about David Mitchell, and it's amazing that He allows me to interview him twice, and then Anthony Mara does the same thing. They're both two great authors. And as I said in the thing, you know, you can read whatever you want, and I'm happy for you to read whatever you want. But if you want to read what's really actually fiction that is comes close to Nikolai Gogol or Franz Kafka, then this is what you want to read. It's rich, it's deep, it's involved, and it requires you to use your brain. And it's not just fun. There's nothing wrong with fun, but it's much more than that. It's what makes us human beings and allows us to gain knowledge as we wander through whatever this is, this life. Well, that certainly made sense. In any event, thanks for joining us today. Our upcoming shows include the really fun Avid Reader Best Books of 2015 Roundup, which I do with Donna McFadden, our manager, and we end up yelling and screaming at each other, but it is a lot of fun. And then after that, New York Times bestselling author Charles Belfour, who wrote The Paris Architect, his recent, most recent work of fiction is House of Thieves, which is also a great book. So upcoming Best Books of 2015 and House of Thieves. Thanks as always for joining us here on The Avid Reader, and we look forward to having you here next week as well.